Thank you for tuning in to Hacks and Hobbies with your host, Junaid. We're visited by our amazing guests coming from all walks of life. We want to learn their story, their struggles, and their journey on how they got to where they are today. So stick around. Welcome back to Hacks and Hobbies. I'm your host, Junaid, and today's guest is a true example of turning necessity into industry-shaking innovation. James Showalter survived multiple hurricanes as a teenager in Houston, where weeks without power pushed him to start tinkering with DIY solar setups. That journey from protecting his own family to disrupting the $100 billion solar industry has made him the founder of Signature Solar, EG4, and Solar 76, companies known for making solar affordable, transparent, and accessible. Today, we'll unpack how he scaled from garage experiments to $70 million in revenue without venture capital, and why his mission to democratize energy is just getting started. James, welcome to the show.
Hey, Junaid, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man, and so excited to have you here. I love that your story starts with survival and necessity rather than a boardroom pitch. Can you take us back to those hurricane days, what you saw, what you felt, and how that sparked your first solar experiments?
Well, that's just, a whole garden path of the human experience, right? You go through different things and they can spark your curiosity, right? So for me, I got interested in solar power with, unreliability problems in hurricanes from where I'm from. And, that basically a lot of times in adversity or trauma can, spark a curiosity. And somewhere in that curiosity, you might find something that looks like an opportunity. And then beyond that opportunity, you may turn that into a calling.
I love that. Absolutely. The adversity, when you go through that, is going to invite curiosity and help you solve problems. Especially electricity is so essential, right? Without it, we can't really do a whole lot. It's required for refrigeration. It's required for keeping the temperature. It's required to, communicate with people all around the world. Talk to me about what were some of the earliest challenges in getting those DIY setups to work?
Well, obviously the initial scope is, for me was trying to find something for my family, which ended up being a really good emotional roadmap understanding of my customers. Mm-hmm. And so creating a solution for my family 15 years ago came down to some of figuring out the right value and cost effective components. And the other part was figuring out how to reduce their energy usage and make sure that they were as efficient as possible.
Yeah.
So the key target was resilient energy. So you would want to generate some, but you would also want to be more efficient. And what I found out very quickly after we built our first system and it barely worked was that supply creates demand and people started wanting more power. So within about 3 or so years, we had probably doubled the power capacity of the system over the original design. So that was an experience. And it also, cuts to a factor that we have to think about in our hardware company today, which is upgradability, expandability, and then also trying to advise people to build systems that, maybe a little more powerful than their absolute minimum needs. Sure. Just because of cost efficiency and time efficiency.
Those are very powerful words, especially when you said, being efficient in storing and then being able to double the capacity. Talk to me about what involved. I want to get a little technical because I geek out on technology myself. Talk to me about what changed, Like, how were you able to double that capacity? Was it mostly the storage part of it, or was it mostly the technology around solar panels that increased or got better?
You had to add a little bit of everything. On the battery bank, I think we had probably an under-quality battery bank. This was 15 years ago. I think I actually tried it with, you know, a chemistry I had no business playing around with, which was Henri Marine batteries. And so I had to replace with golf cart batteries as my next step. And I did twice as powerful of a bank. So that was just a complete, you know, tear out and replace. And then on the solar panel side, we had started with like 8 solar panels from BP was into making solar panels back in the day, and they had gone out of business. So I had 8 overstocked solar panels from them. And I think I added another 4 or 5 panels from Astro Energy at the time. So, you know, we were able to expand the solar rack. And I think like in that one case, we had to, you know, tear out and replace the batteries. But it's just, you know, good old decade plus or more technology problems that we had back in the off-grid space back then.
That's right. That's right. Now, when did you realize that this was bigger than a hobby? Was it the like you mentioned, was it the supply and demand that people wanted, or was it something entirely different?
Yeah, I think it went from being a hobby to a business, and then from a business to being really, you know, a passion that, you know, took me beyond just trying to make a buck and provide for myself. So
yeah.
I think while it was a hobby for me, I actually started my first business, which was a ranch construction service business. We built fences and decks and barns and stuff like that out in the my rural county in Texas. And that was when I was 18. I started just moonlighting on the weekends. By the time I was 19, I quit my job at the hardware store and full-time was contracting. And then I think what happened that kind of dragged solar into what I do and making a business out of it was that, people in the county, it's small town, small county area. And they kind of got wind. I was the kid who had taken my family off grid. And so I had enough people that were like, hey, could you build one of those systems for me?
Yeah.
And then I had to look at it a completely different way, which was, what is the value prop here? You know, because, what I was tapping into as a DIYer was just a really irrational passion to build, own your own power, which I think is something that's actually core in the American psyche. But you know, that transition was, you know, just a couple people that I knew that I was doing other small projects for that were trying to draft me into building a system or two for them.
That's amazing. I love the story when you solve a problem and people say, hey, I want to solve that same problem that you've solved. Come help me, come work with me. And it's like you said, it's ingenuity of, you know, you figuring out, hey, this is something that I can help others with. This is something that's going to elevate not just my lifestyle or but others as well. Now, you've also said that the solar industry was opaque. They were overpriced and they were tough for newcomers. And that was very true, you know, multiple years ago. What were the top 3 pain points that you felt that had to be fixed?
Well, you know, I think what you're getting into is really the next pivot for me, which was moving from being an installer into being a hardware supplier. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that I defined, I was selling installed systems in rural Texas, and we were selling them for less than half the cost installed that people in the urban areas were paying from these big box installers who had non-informational, anti-transparent sales pitches. I think there's a lot of people nowadays. Back then, we knew it would probably end up in a bad place. There's a lot of people nowadays that did do a solar system that regret it. And it's typically, you know, people that bought from those kind of approaches. And so I was at a point where I could scale up my install company and try to compete, change the competitive landscape for installs. But I think what I really tapped into was, well, the other alternative, which is much riskier, is trying to be the supply house that would make more people like me. Which is, you know, how do we start really improving the do-it-yourself solar marketplace for components and then create a funnel to shepherd do-it-yourselfers, which tended to have trade skills, like in my own case, myself, you know, shepherd those people into then, you know, selling honest, transparent installed systems and doing things in a way where the customer knew what the cost of the hardware was. And so I think it was one of the riskier things about it was that, you know, I knew how to linearly grow my business with a competitive advantage and in a market that had a demand for reliable power. But the bigger fish was get on the internet, get on the phone and meet people like me all over the United States that were going through the same journey. They were, you know, building off-grid systems for their home, for their families, typically. And, you know, tended to come from a trade background. And, you know, if they understood it well enough, they might even offer install services, you know, in their local communities.
That's so powerful. I love the ingenuity and I love the creativity behind it, too. Right. Like, hey, I'm good with tools. All you got to do is figure out a few little things here and there, and you're able to put this system together to solve that problem. Now, as you're combating this industry and you know, making sure that you're providing a valuable service, a valuable product to your customers and moving from becoming an installer to a hardware supplier, what was the most frustrating industry norm that you decided to break when you did that?
Well, there was a tendency in the DIY space back in 2019, 2020 for DIY hardware suppliers to not compete on the hardware price level. Instead, look like they were competing against an installed system. Mm-hmm. So they had no shame in marking things up over 100%, 150% for the hardware. And I felt the hardware, you know, needed to take a house off grid. You know, it's still typically four digits. It's still over $10,000 for a lot of, you know, obviously energy is a regular monthly expense that you can justify that with. That's hundreds of dollars. But people guilted me a lot, even the ones that were just getting to know me for not taking the kind of margin I could take the way that all the other DIYer supply houses were taking at that time. They looked at themselves as a competitive alternative to installed systems, which were 400% or 300% more than the hardware. They're like, we'll mark the hardware up 70 to 100%. And I felt like, no, what's missing is the Home Depot of solar, essentially. What's missing is a hardware store that charges an honest margin and gets you good help. And you can do that for 25 points of margin standard and then ultimately create a wholesale division that, you know, makes 10, 15 points.
And that was,
I guess, the business model I was going for. The thing of, I wish I had a solar Home Depot when I was a do-it-yourselfer, just kind of overrode all of the, James, you're leaving too much money on the table, business advice that I had all kinds of people trying to push me into.
So that's what helped you form the, I would call it the solar depot, right? Go here to get your parts to build your own solar system. And I'm sure the customers responded with, oh my God, this is the place I want to go to. Everybody else is overcharging because customers are smart. You know, they're always doing their research. They're always looking, okay, where can I get the best bang for my buck? Talk to me about how did customer respond when you made solar more transparent for them?
Well, there's a huge human aspect to how they responded and how that drove us getting off the ground. You know, it just started out, I think 2019, I was the only person there. And we booked about, probably for the parts store, about $3 million of revenue, you know, with all the different hardware. And what the real hook there was that they would message and I would get on the phone with them and I would care about the project. And I obviously had installed hundreds of systems professionally. So they were talking to someone who really knew what they were doing. And again, also, it shows when you don't have an attitude of trying to take the most you can get from a customer. And so that was the hook that I think helped us build, build a market base and then grow from that, where people would then send their friends and their friends' friends. You know, I pick up the phone with one guy in early 2020 for this one. And I ended up getting, I think, 15 of his friends to buy systems like over time, because they all snowballed the way that, technical DIY hobbies did. And so that was the initial hook. And it was the only hook I've ever really trusted since, was that, okay, by the time that you're doing a major changeover on your house for something you really care about, and you're going to spend $10,000 or so, or even for a small project, 5 or 6, you need to be able to talk to a human being who succeeded at it. There's a confidence gap that you're dealing with in the early adoption side. And that's where we got involved in a lot of, as we scaled the company up to the hundreds of employees that we got to, when we got involved in our own training center, our own talent building capacity to try to build confidence and expertise on the other side of the line for people who are making these decisions to go ahead and try to build the project.
Wow, James, that is absolutely amazing, because most founders get stuck on funding. They're like, hey, where do I get the funding from? But what's amazing is that you were able to scale by being more human, by being more transparent, by being more customer-centric, and scale your company to $70 million without that venture capital. And that's really rare, especially in this energy tech. I absolutely love that.
And, you know, we stayed out of venture capital. I mean, even as we, like last year, we crossed over the $300 million line, right? Mm-hmm. We stayed out of that the whole time. But to your point, Junaid, it was also... we kept a really tight cash flow cycle. Coming out of the install business, I kind of worked a trade with my brother. He got the install company. I didn't make any money selling the company to him. And I got the retained earnings. And that was about $1 million. And so, we were able to just, I've always felt like you only deserve the hand you have to bet with. So we just bet with that and grew. And then by 2022, we crossed that first $70 million. We got our first bank. And it was still a very limited, partnership, because if they were like, you came out of, nothing in 3 years
without any right.
backers.
Yeah.
Are you in the drug business?
Yeah. I love that, man. That's really powerful. And, it clearly shows that you didn't really take a whole lot of risks, or maybe there were some risks, without having to take that VC-backed founder might avoid.
I think the biggest risk was setting out for an objective that I knew was going to be exactly on the mark, but leaving a good opportunity to do that. We could have just kept growing the install company in a linear way. That would have been, a guaranteed option. I was 23 I had already made my first $1 million technically, with retained earnings to the install company when I transferred to my brother. Mm-hmm. So, it wasn't like the country or people weren't going to need or want what we were offering. It was just a matter of how do we do it in a way where we don't drown? Mm-hmm. And I say that now, I probably understood that a little less well back then, but I did have a mentality where we only did deserve to play with the chips we had. So we didn't leverage the company up in that get off the ground scenario. And what we also had was I created exit doors if we overbet. So a lot of this came down to what did you acquire? How good of a cost could you acquire it in terms of equipment, hardware, inventory, and then, turn around and sell that. And so I created back channels to broker off stuff if I had bet wrong, where I could make, 2 or 3, 5 points on it and move on and then recycle the cash for something else that I was going to bet on. So it still had the facade of a relatively stable, supply of different things. But, if I overbet on one batch or the other to get an advantage, I could broker out or separate that. So I tried to explain this to somebody back then, like 2021 timeframe, and they just kind of blew their mind, like not just all the procurement stuff we were doing and scaling up service, but also all of our, I created two or three exit doors for everything we jumped into. So we could broker out fast or do a fire sale on a platform like eBay and move on. So that was, if I had two exit doors and a main plan, I would do it. And that's how I risk managed.
Man, that's really smart. Having those exit doors, having the plan in place. And I'm sure that just doesn't came out of thin air. You know, that takes a ton of experience, a ton of practice of actually working with customers, working with vendors, working with companies. I absolutely love the way you explain that. Now, talk to me about how do you prioritize speed versus sustainability in that growth? You said you sold a company and your brother's running it. What were the two, how did you prioritize those two things?
Well, you know, the transfer, the install company to my brother, that was a reasonable structure that would allow me to focus, right? When you talk about how do you prioritize speed versus growth, I tend to think about focus. And I probably value it a little more today than I did back then. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for me, it was, I need to be able to focus on one thing. I knew I could not run an install company and a hardware supplier, you know, company, value add hardware supply company at the same time. It's just two different sides of your brain and so many different pieces to go after. Yeah. So that was an easy trade-off. And I felt like the decisions that give you focus, you need to act, you need to have a speed mentality. You need to understand that if you're unfocused, you need to get focused in business. And typically you need to make a transaction that allows that to win-win, that allows it to happen fast instead of overthinking it. And then on the growth side, I mean, I think I was always overwork yourself and then fill the hole. Overwork yourself, fill the hole, right? Pay for your next employee and then hire that employee and then pay for your next employee. So for me, booking that, you know, close to $3 million in revenue in 2019, just from the parts store, that made me confident that I could afford an employee or two. And that was honestly, you know, when I ran the install company, it was, I would contract my brothers to help me. It was a lot less, hey, I asked someone to take a job with me and not take a job somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
And so I hired my first employee in February of 2020. And that's a different kind of stress and strain for sure that we had to deal with.
Amazing. Amazing lessons here, James. Thank you so much for sharing. This has absolutely been powerful. Now, solar can be intimidating. I've been thinking about putting solar on my roof for a long time. You know, it's going to cut our electricity bill. But apparently, we have too tall of trees in our backyard that basically dropped the score from 90% to like 83%. I'm like, okay, I guess it might not make sense. Anyhow, how do you take something complex and make it approachable for homeowners and DIYs, because I might be your next customer, who knows?
Yeah. Well, you know, how do I make it simple for somebody like you? Well, I mean, honestly, one of the biggest hindrances for solar, and we always focused on areas that were outside of this. We got a lot of our customers from rural areas, but one of the problems that people deal with, and I think a majority of homes in America, is the burden of regulation, right? So if you want to put a solar system in, if you're going to buy from someone or you were to put one in yourself, you've got to pull a permit process that in most states can take, you know, 3 to 6 months. It's kind of crazy.
Wow.
Texas and Florida, we've been active in, you know, in some pushes that are cutting things down to a 2-day permit override. Texas passed that, and so did Florida. So those are two examples of areas that I just would say, like, as a step one, without getting into a prolonged permit fight, I don't know, you know, what city do you live in,
Jimmy? I'm in Virginia.
Okay. You're in Virginia, and in what city?
Northern, so Reston area.
Yeah, exactly. So some area like that is probably going to have you know, as pro-solar as the politicians may say that they are, right? They have typically, they still take each solar system like it's a nuke power plant. And it's really, really irritating. So we want to see that those things change. And that's one thing that a lot of people in high permitting areas were not in the middle of the DIY picture in our experience. But if you get past that, then the question is, what I would say is the only solar install that you're going to be proud of investing in is one where you knew actually what the hardware cost.
Yes.
And that, I think that's a huge test there. Don't get into any solar install deal where you don't know where the hardware cost is. I like to joke that if you did not have oil available in automotive stores and you had to only go to a repair shop to get your oil change, you'd be paying $400 for an oil change. That's kind of the situation that solar is in right now. People don't know how much the car oil, the motor oil costs. People don't know how much the solar panels and the batteries cost. People don't know that a solar panel is $120, right? They don't know how much a battery system, you know, costs. It's, you know, that's a transparency thing that I would say as an investor, if you're leaning to your own installed system, go get a DIY quote. Call up Signature and get a DIY quote. I mean, I know you're wasting a little bit of our time, but you'll probably tell some of your DIY friends to come buy from us. But go get a DIY quote and then ask some intelligent questions. And if you irk your installer, that's good. You weren't supposed to buy from that guy, right? and so I would say that transparency is there from, you know, full service DIY places like Signature. And I would really recommend that that's actually your first step. And I'd also say educate yourself a little bit about how your power company works with battery tied systems. There are very few systems that don't have batteries that are going to be good investments. That's the other intrinsic problem with the kind of products that the install companies are selling. And Signature does a lot to educate you on that in terms of, you know, walking you through how you can put in a battery system to where you don't have to sell power to your power company, so you're not at their mercy to pay you back for it. And also you get whole home backup as part of the deal.
Yeah.
There's a home valuation play that works in solar, which is when you put a system with batteries in that can back up your whole house as effectively as a whole home generator, then you actually improve the value of your house. And of course, it doesn't depend on buyback from the power company. So it reliably cuts your power bill. That play works. When you're putting in these grid dependent systems that have no backup, which is what most of solar has been so far, you know, that's another education gap. Signature is incredibly battery attached focused for this reason. We don't believe in the batteryless systems. We think that they are very, very risky investments, and typically only get sold to people that are, you know, forcibly undereducated in that sales process.
Wow. That is some powerful information, and it's something that I did not know, that people are actually selling systems without batteries, and kind of makes sense, but it kind of is pointless. Like, you're only getting power when it's daylight, but other times you're dependent on that electrical grid system anyways. Tesla's entered the market, you know, a few years ago with their beautiful tile system that goes on the roof. I don't know if it's it's deployed yet. Maybe it is in some places, but they also have the power walls. Does that compare? And, you know, how, like, if you were to rank it comparatively to other systems, what would you say?
Well, you know, Tesla is one of our competitors. I think in the residential market, we're a private company still. So we don't have to share our numbers. From our internal data, we're the number two residential battery company in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the number one is Tesla. You know, I think what we've seen with Tesla, we have a lot of respect for them. Mm-hmm. There are some companies in the industry that got too comfortable with their position and never innovated fast enough on value and effectiveness. Tesla really has tried. I think they optimize for a different customer than us. Which is why I think we really love it when we find Tesla installers that we're telling, hey, you should also carry EG4 and you should carry EG4 and Tesla. Because of Tesla, I think is we have an advantage on the bigger homes, the medium, large, and larger homes. And we think, you know, the Powerwall is a really slick system with a well-known brand for the smaller homes, you know, your one battery homes. But we're really focused on places like where I grew up in rural Texas, where, you know, to get a home off, you know, completely off of grid dependence price-wise, they need 2 to 3 of those big 300-pound batteries. And we try to tell people, look, you know, if you're doing a medium to large home and you didn't lead with us, we think we're the best value in that category. If you didn't lead with us, you lost that sale for no good reason. You know, and that's a, you know, I think that there's a value game. Yeah. I've actually viewed the competition landscape more like us competing against the toughest power grids to compete against. Our goal is to reach grid parity in the toughest markets, the lowest prices, the most anti-solar policies, and just brute force with technological value there.
Yeah.
Because the overall capacity of the residential space has still yet to be realized. I think that there's maybe $1 trillion, maybe a little more, of residential solar and storage hardware alone, just hardware, not to mention labor that needs to be deployed.
All of that stuff is in storage. So you're saying there's a ton of
50% of homes had this.
Wow. That's amazing. There's a recent story sorry, go ahead.
Hopefully that $1 trillion gets reduced with innovation and, you know, cost improvements. I still think that we're at a critical mass. I think it's since the last 8 months of our current generation of product, we can compete with any power company in America for price per kilowatt hour on an installed system and definitely on a do-it-yourself system. And that's not mentioning the fact that you get whole home backup as part of the deal, which is theoretically worth, you know, $15,000 or so.
Exactly. That's really powerful. James, this was a lot of fun. Thank you so much. You know, you've shared so much, and I'm even more intrigued to learn even more on what's actually possible and having battery backup as part of the solar panel installation. I think is the number one reason why you would even get solar. Like, what's the point otherwise? This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much. And I was recently saw that China has had a system installed since 2016 or maybe earlier, almost a 10 square mile area filled with solar panels, creating like multiple gigawatts of energy. I'm like, why don't we have systems like that in the U.S.? Maybe we do. Maybe we do. I just don't know of it.
That's a good question. I think understanding China a little bit helps understand how they're going to go adopt renewable technology and the difference in the way that America's going to adopt next generation technology. And I think, you know, battery technology can also help, you know, fossil dependent grids prop up their loads and improve reliability. So I think battery technology is a great partner for renewables. I think it's just as good of a partner for fossil fuels, for coal and gas-fired generation. But China, to understand that country, you've got 1.4 billion people. You have only one coast. America's three coasts. We have the Gulf Coast, the Atlantic Coast, and the West Coast. So China has only one coast, and they have four times as many people. They are incredibly densely populated. So the way that they're going to work is large utility scale developments run by the state grid, and that's going to feed cities with as cost-effective power as they can. And there are certain, you know, they're not a free market system, which is a lot of flaws, but also at the same time, they recognize maintaining cost-effective power as a national interest. In the U.S., we're a little more free market, which of creates these investor-owned utility companies that, in theory, have a responsibility to the ratepayers, the homeowners like you and me, and the government granted them a monopoly, and they should be loyal to that, but in practice have a bigger responsibility to their stock value, which is you know, a separate thing. So, okay, so how does that feed into America? Well, we're much more spread out. We've got much more single family dwelling units and small businesses. And we have a tradition of individual liberty that, and just an ethics that pushes us that direction. So we're going to have individuals adopt it And I think America, if we do solar right, it's going to look like a lot of small systems, very cost effectively deployed, not like what we've had in the past, but much more cost effectively deployed in an open source manner across 50% of American homes and businesses.
Man, I love that. Thank you so much, James, for bringing that clarity. I had no idea, and that totally makes sense. You know, they're a government-run government or country, whereas we have more independence here in the U.S. Thank you so much.
We've got a free market, and this technology is telling is giving customers the tools to compete with the power company. So you know, the power company wants to run a competitive game and run up their stock price. Well, we can use technology to compete with them and hold them accountable. Exactly. And that's I think the thing that'll help everybody is we need our power companies to wake up in a reality where if they don't do a good enough job reducing the cost of energy, homeowners will do it for themselves.
Yes, they will. Well, James, thank you so much again. Your journey from tinkering teenager to industry disruptor is inspiring, and it's clear that your mission is about more than just selling panels. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. See you later, Janae. Bye.
In part two, we'll dive deeper into the future of solar, the impact of manufacturing in the U.S., and how anyone listening can achieve energy independence without breaking the bank. Stick around. This next part will change the way you think about power. Thanks, and we'll see you in the next one. Congratulations, you made it to the end of the episode. Thanks so much for listening to our guest on this episode. Please send me an email at Junaid@hacksandhobbies.com to tell me what you loved about our guest today. You could find links mentioned in this episode on the hacksandhobbies.com website.